Blog Talk Radio.
Hit it.
What's happening? Hey, check it out. The real future threat to this bullshit imperialistic way of life lies with a majority of elected officials who believe their white, painted, and perceived God is what the rest of the uncivilized world needs to simply be. Overstand, the Christian by any means policy reads, if at first the third world slave doesn't convert, cut all aid. If that doesn't work, occupy their country and start chopping off the limbs of every infant you see. Then in front of their raped and tied up mothers, throw the remains on the ground and douse with gasoline. Don't worry, what's the sound of the flames are louder than the screams? The rest will race to their knees to pray to our white King of Kings. Or at least that's what I heard Uncle Sam say in his address to the nation on NBC last night, ironically before Law and Order, thus explaining why all non-Christians and Jews are being detained on site, at home, and across the border.
Yes, yes. That was Monty Smith, and before that was obviously
KRS-One and Boogie Down Productions with Why Is That? And I am Solomon, and this is Your World News, and I will be joined, and we will be joined very momentarily by Your World News's managing editor for our online site, and that is none other than Andrea Zamudio. She'll be joining us in a few minutes, live from somewhere in the Empire being the United Snakes, the divided snakes of America, and we got a really important show today, folks. I'm just not even 24 hours back in the Empire. I was outside the Empire, and I know it's because of this economic quagmire that many of us are stuck in, are just immersed in, and cannot move, like we're stuck in a pool of molasses, that it's really difficult for us to travel outside of the Empire. You know, sometimes, and it's very difficult for me to travel as well, and I had to save my pennies for a long time to make this trip, but I was able to step outside the Empire, and I'm back in the U.S. now, but it really clears your head, and it gives you another perspective when you leave the U.S. and go someplace else. And really see humanity in a different way, and how things are done, in countries that have not even a sliver of the GDP that the United States puts forth every year, gross national product, but these countries, it's just really nice to see humanity. Just I'll leave it at that, in a much different framework and an understanding of humanity and people and education, you know, primary and secondary, and how that primary and secondary education produces folks that understand culture, that understand the role they play in this big bad world that we live in. Something that U.S. education just does not purposely put forth. And that's why this show is right on time. And I want to lay the groundwork, folks. This is a show, whether you're listening live or on archive, please listen to the entire show. If you're listening live, listen and call in if you want. But if not, rock back and listen to our perspectives, and that we may be sharing the same perspectives. And if so, take the link. If you appreciate the show, send it off to all your networks. Take a break from sending these meaningless chain emails. These chain emails. You got to send this email out to 14 people, and if you do, you'll be blessed. Take a break from those emails. Take a break from your Facebook. Send this out, and let's encourage folks to listen, and after they listen, let's encourage dialogues within our own communities, whether it's our family or a group of friends or even beyond that. These dialogues that we're about to immerse ourselves in right now don't take place enough in the U.S. on purpose. They certainly don't take place in the governmentally sanctioned so-called educational centers known as public education in America. That's not disseminated on the mainstream corporate media. And this is a discussion on America's ethnic misnomers. We're going to be discussing everything from the terms that so many Americans refer to one another, or not one another, but to refer to as other people as, referring to Spanish-speaking indigenous folks as Spanish or Hispanic. And even though Latino or Latina is better than Hispanic or Spanish, if it's an indigenous person whose roots are entrenched in the beginnings of the population in what's now known as North America, or even South America, the Caribbean, these people are not Latin based. They're original language, it was not Spanish. It was Lakota or Wichita, Quechua, Aymara, Mayan. We can go on and on. You know, now if they're mestizo or mestiza, then that's a different story. That's a, you know, combination of indigenous and African and in some cases, but indigenous and Spaniard. We're going to be breaking down those things. We're going to be breaking down the mascots, the vile, racist, dehumanizing mascots that we see throughout America's professional sports world, and even, you know, college realm and in some cases high school level. You know, so we're gonna be talking about a lot of these different things. Not equating the whole. We're gonna break down the whole equation of America's equating Arabs to being just universally Muslim, or Muslims being universally Arab, a range of things. We're destructing it completely. So that's our show for today. And before we get things kicked off, I want to have a warm Your World News welcome to Andrea Zamudio. And if you listen, you know, if you check out yourworldnews.org, that's Y-O-U-R. WORLDNEWS.org. That's not news with a Z, it's news with an S. Your World News .org. That's our web platform. You can go there, you can get everything from videos to great articles. Just click on the blogs section of the website, and that will take you to our blog session where you can find a range of videos and documentaries and well-written news pieces from folks like Andrea Zamudio, for one, Stephen Lindman, Danny Weil, you know, and if you're an aspiring writer, if you're an author, if you're a well-established author, you know, and you're activist-oriented and you want to get information out there that quite frankly, mainstream America does not accept. And, you know, we would love to have you write for us, you know, and you can do so by, like I said, you know, tuning in and emailing us at yourworldnews2010@gmail.com. And so without further ado, Andrea, you with us?
Yeah, I'm with you. Can you
welcome.
Hear me?
And yes, are you loud and clear? And clear. And so she's not in the dungeon this week in the Your World News studio dungeon with me, but she's joined us from parts unknown somewhere within the empire. I can smell it. I can, like Chavez said, I can smell the sulfur. I don't think it's George Bush. I think it's just America in general. But Andrea, what do you think the importance of this show that we're about to embark upon is?
You know, like you mentioned, a lot of these conversations are not had we just don't have them in classrooms in the United States or even amongst your friends. You know, people use these words every day. They use black. They use, oh, I saw that Spanish girl, or that guy who is brown-skinned and is wearing a turban is Muslim. All these things are said, but there's no discussion of what they really mean. Is that actually correct, or are you just generalizing? And I always find it interesting that there's no discussion of different ethnicities within white culture, or how that's really the only ethnic group in the United States that has really blended, as in, like, you know, Italian Americans or Irish Americans or you know, whatever, British Americans. After so many generations, they're really the only mixed group that we could actually make generalizations about, versus other people from different parts of the world coming from completely different countries, speaking completely different languages, are somehow just diluted by these words that are imposed on us. So I think it's important that we really look at these names that are given to people of color in the United States and how they affect our own perceptions of ourselves individually and as a community, and how it affects us politically.
And what do you mean by politically? What would be an example of that?
Well, I mean, I think it's mixed. So if we don't have a basis as a community ourselves of how to identify and what that means to us, how are we going to demand anything for us and for ourselves? And so we're not organizing politically because we don't even understand our own roots. And we're allowing a political structure that's dominated by, historically by white rich men to define us.
Right. You're right. You're right. And have come to worship these rich white men, you know,
right.
You know, and kids get it. So they, because they're a tabula rasa, if you will, they're a blank slate. And so, they're so impressionable that they have these nascent minds. And so, you know, but when you present things to them and you in one way, for instance, you know, talking about Christopher Columbus or George Washington,
mm-hmm.
it would be the furthest thing from their mind, you know, based on what they learn about holidays. That holidays are a celebration. So a lot of holidays are a celebration of what historical figures did. And you know, why would these holidays be celebrated if they did some things bad? And so, when you talk to kids and you frame it in a different way, you know, I had the opportunity to do that a couple weeks ago with a group of middle school students, and we had a discussion on slavery, and I asked them what they thought about slavery, and they mentioned that, you know, all these different things is bad. And I said, well, why is it bad? You know, articulate why was it bad? You know, why is it bad? Well, you know, it's bad because you're holding someone against your will, and you're working them, and you're working them against their will, and you know, all these different things, and you know, that they started to articulate in terms of what they had learned about slavery, because obviously in the U.S., I knew they knew about that, because you know, when they talk about Black people's history, you know, historically they start with slavery as the beginning of African people's history, which is not the case. I mean, it goes back, you know, tens of thousands of years. You know, the basis of civilization and culture and all these things, you know, came out of the southern cradle, the cradle of Africa. They're not taught these things, but here, you know, that's the first thing that they're taught. So I knew that they were going to have some kind of basis of what slavery was. And so they you know, they articulated what, you know, all the bad things about slavery. And so I said, well, if I was a slave owner, If I owned people, you know, I mean, first of all, just to say that is disgusting in and of itself. But if I did own people, would you still think I'm a good guy? You guys have met me. Would you still think I'm a good guy? And they're like, no, that was totally that's a game changer. No, you wouldn't be a good guy. I'm like, come on, what are you talking about? You know me, I'm a nice guy. This thing is, well, we find out that you own slaves. No, that's a game changer. It is a game changer. And I'm like, okay, yeah, you're right. It is a game changer. And I'm glad you guys get that. So my next question, Andre, was I asked him, okay, well, some of you guys, you said you wouldn't be my friend anymore. You wouldn't trust me if I owned people, if I owned slaves or I enslaved anybody. Well, some of you guys celebrate. You celebrate slave owners. Well, I'm not saying it's a bad. Well, it is a bad thing, but I'm not saying that you're a bad people because you do that. And they're like, no, we don't. And I was like, yes, you do. You guys ever heard of President's Day? Like, yeah. And you can see their face, like, you know, totally blank. But yeah. I was like, well, all right. Let's take, for instance, George Washington, who you know is honored on President's Day.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that he owned over 300 slaves? 300 African slaves. It blew their mind, and they said, "No, we didn't know that." I mean, they were almost offended that, you know, that they didn't know that. So I said, "Yes, this man owned over 300 slaves, and he found all the different loopholes, especially and even when the U.S. Capitol was in Philadelphia, he found a way to rotate his slaves in every several months, so to get around a certain mandate that, you know, in terms of slave ownership in that area of the country, you know, rotating them from there to, you know, his plantation in Virginia. And it totally was a game changer. We talked about Columbus. I mean, so these things have a lot to do, as you said, with people's identification of values as well. So yeah, you're right, Andre. Politically, and values are shaped. You know, people's politics are shaped by their values. Their values in terms of what they think about people and all these different types of things. And so these kids got it, and they were much easier to work with than most adults are, because most adults who have been conditioned this way, by the time they get to a certain age, most of them, not all, but most of them are totally, invaluable from being shaped or to even have a slight door ajar towards the world of inquiry. And so it's really this younger generation that it's so important. But as we know, we see these regressive changes going on in the state of Texas and so forth, where they're literally rewriting the history books in a more conservative right-wing manner. We see what's going on in Arizona, and this is basically they're basically mandating what has already been going on in all the states so far. So it's kind of amusing to go up in arms, because I mean, they should be up in arms, but you should have been up in arms 10 years ago, 20 years ago. This has been going on for a while, and as I mentioned, Texas, you know, it seems like we have a caller from Texas, and I just want to take this call to kind of lead off the show, and then we're going to go to a clip that is going to set the table towards us understanding even things like language and why so many indigenous people from the Western Hemisphere speak Spanish as opposed to, say, Wichita. So we're going to get into that. But, caller, you're on the line right about now. Well, having a little technical difficulty. Caller, you're on the line from the 972 area code. I think that's Dallas. Any comments or questions or anything else?
Hello, Brother Solomon.
Hello?
Can I be heard?
Yeah, it's a familiar voice. Would this be Sarah?
Hey, Brother Solomon and Miss Andrea.
Hello.
Doing?
This is your favorite defender.
Yes. Hopefully, we're gonna have that mental midget calling in from
Montana.
Yeah, right.
I was just listening to the call to hear what y'all. It sounds like it's going to be a very interesting discussion that you're going to be opening up. So, I don't want to get into it this early in the game. I just want y'all to have a chance to really go out and lay out everything out there. But I'm glad that you're making the genocide with Christopher Colombo and what he has done to devastate the Americas, the disease that he brought, the genocide that they brought with them to this part of the hemisphere. So
mm-hmm.
And people want to, of course, say that he discovered something. If you have to discover something, you first of all have to be lost, and none of these people in the Western Hemisphere was lost.
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
We like
you're
to
right.
Give,
you're right.
We give credit to these people as being genius when these people were homicidal maniacs who raped, murdered, did disastrous things, wiped out people with their nasty diseases, venereal diseases, and other diseases they brought over from Europe. So I will be listening in, and I will come if you could come back to me later on. I would be more than happy if you haven't, to get some additional questions once y'all start going through the discussion.
And if I can ask you a question, because you don't have a Texas accent, and so I know where your accent is from, and it's from a part of the world I was just in. Where are you from originally?
Originally, I always tell them, I said I'm a first American. I'm a South American.
Okay.
My people are from South America. My mother and father, they are from. My mother is West Indian. She's from Barbados.
Guyana. Okay,
yes,
Barbados.
My father
is
Chinese. So we were plus all my grandmother's indigenous, and they would refer to them as Amerindian, which are the original Indians.
Yes.
So
exactly,
we are
yes.
First Nation people.
Yeah, you're right. I just came back from Trinidad, and you know, the people that were there were the Carib and Arawak, and Columbus, stepped his dirty feet there as well and wrecked the carnage upon them, where you cannot find any Amerindian Indians in Tobago or Trinidad, which I was at both places. But you're exactly right. Their wrath didn't have many boundaries whatsoever. I mean, you had the conquistadors in South America and and Central America. I mean, it was just this wrath of destruction that was just wreaked havoc, you know, upon so many people throughout the entire globe. I mean, because you look at the British Empire. I mean, everywhere from India all the way to the West Indies. You know. The so-called West Indies, it was just carnage and destruction everywhere.
You've got to look at it like these people are a bunch of homicidal maniacs. That's what I call Caucasian people. If they take offense or not, hey, that's a compliment. I'm just saying it in a nice fashion, because you need to realize they're one of the people that came from a tribe called the Vandals. This is where we get the word vandalism from.
Yes.
They have lived up to
yeah.
their name, Attila the Hun. So you have to see the nature of these people. These are the beasts of these people. There has not been anywhere they have set their diseased feet on that they have not destroyed. They went into Australia, Tasmania, New Zealand, everywhere these people have set their diseased self. They have always destroyed the population. They have went from majority to minority in every continent, and they are about to do the same to the Asian continent, as well as they are reinvading the African continent again, to take over it again. So these people, they are destructive by nature, and as I keep telling them, I said they're like children. They like to destroy and break things, and they don't know how to put it back together, or they don't care to put it back together.
You're right. Thank you for calling. I really appreciate it. And if any time during the rest of this dialogue that you want to call back in and chime in, we always appreciate your insight.
I'm just looking forward to you touching on the topic with Asian and the Arab topic, because we need to make a distinction between Arab, because Arab is a language. Arab is not a race of people.
Exactly.
It's the language. People always like to say, oh, these Arabs. These Arabs could
be
a black person. It could be myself. If I speak the language, then I could be considered an Arab. It doesn't have nothing to do with a race of people. We're seeing these people that's running around, these Indo-Aryans that are over there, and we are referring to them as being Arabs, the people in Saudi Arabia and these other areas as being Arabs. No, they're not Arabs. They're Indo-Aryans. And they happen to speak the Arabic dialect. But there are Arabs that are black people. There are Arabs that are Chinese. It has to do with the dialect that you speak, not what you look like.
You're exactly right. Yeah, so we'll definitely be touching on that.
I'll tune into the rest of the conversation. You just go ahead and just put me on mute, and y'all just continue on with the dialogue, or I'll just call back in to make it much simpler.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. All right.
Thanks, Solomon and Andrea.
Thank you.
That was good. She was right on point, and we're gonna get into all that. It was like she was reading our minds, because we put a lot of time into this. But she's exactly right. You look at, for instance, Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, soon to be Northern Sudan. He's a black man. He's a black African. He is Arab. Speaks Arabic. And so she's right. It's a language and cultural distinction. The same way Latino is. And we've had this conversation, Andre, plenty of times. You being someone from Colombia. That Latino is not a race, and I wish people would look at when they fill out applications, it says non-white, Hispanic. I mean, that's letting you know that Latino, Hispanic, they are not races. They're cultural distinctions, devil that used to be the president of your country, Uribe, he is undoubtedly a European from Colombia, and his roots are, his ancestry goes back to Spain, and he happens to speak Spanish, but he's not indigenous. He's European, if he was here, you would classify him as Latino, but he's certainly not, anything other than in terms of the racial distinction, and race only describes phenotype, but his phenotype is a white man, correct? We've had this discussion, Andrea?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I think it's good to make these comparisons with Arab being, they're pan ethnicities. They're terms that are created to encompass a group of people from a certain region of the world, but there's no discussion of the diversity that comes within that group, that people have tons of nationalities. And then within each country, there's so much diversity that racially and linguistically.
Right. You mentioned linguistically. This is a good segue because, and I'm going to play something right now, but one of the things that we want to deconstruct, folks, is looking at the prism that we've been programmed, that we've been imposed to look through constantly within the U.S. And it's through a Eurocentric prism. Everything starts with Europe, whether you think it or not, or whether you believe it or not. Everything is a Eurocentric basis in terms of beauty, in terms of language, everything. I mean, even the whole reference to the part of the world typically called the Middle East. Why we call it the Middle East as opposed to Western Asia? We call it the Middle East because the Europeans that distinguished that place, the Middle East, which is now called the Middle East, they placed Europe in the center of the globe. They placed Europe being the center of the world, the center of the world. And so this is going to be the Middle East, and then that over there is going to be the Far East. But we have to begin to look at the world from a different prism if we want to really understand what's going on and really be more worldly than just having ourselves continue to be limited. And I say ourselves, and this could be Black, Latino, Indigenous Latino, Asian Pacific Islander, what have you, even white. Even white, if you're an open-minded white person and you want to be more in touch with humanity, then you need to force yourself into positions of discomfort and try to step outside that box and that box of privilege that you're in. I don't care if you live in a trailer or in a mansion. If you're white in America, you do have a certain amount of privilege, and that is undoubtedly a fact. So I'm going to play this important piece, and we're going to dissect this. And this was a piece that was on Al Jazeera sometime last year, and I thought it would be a good piece, a good starting piece, and it's about 3 minutes. But when we think about language, or I guess we don't think about language that much, but language is a centerpiece of culture. Language is a centerpiece of culture, and if you look at the whole evolution of languages in this world and the initial languages, that we saw, like initially with the Khoisan people in East Africa, where we can undoubtedly say is the starting point of humankind, and from that humankind, and that initial culture, which was largely agrarian, and I also want to say it was largely matriarchal. There was a reverence around the woman, and it wasn't until a lot of these, what we would consider these Western cultures that were very nomadic and based out of these nomadic imprints that were left, there was a lot of foraging and a lot of competition, a lot of fighting that occurred. And that fighting, it was important for folks who were stronger. And so that paved the way for, these patriarchal societies. But folks, you have to also understand the original people of Europe were the African Grimaldi, and these folks were Black Africans, and because of the change in climate and the body having to adapt to the lower amount of sun and the vitamin D and those types of things, that's where we saw over probably about 20,000 to 25,000 years, as historian Sheikh Anta Diop and Ivan Van Sertima and Dr. Charles Finch have taught us that this is where Europeans were birthed. The phenotypical traits went from black to white, skin tone, noses changed, even the stringy hair. These were all environmental adaptations, and we'll get into that. But language was something that came out of the peoples who were starting to populate the world. And I want to look at the indigenous people of Turtle Island, otherwise known as the U.S., North America.
Dash, he get just a he get scuffed.
Listen, you're hearing a language that soon will fall silent forever. Here's the story again in English.
A long time ago, man never known on earth was all alone. Then he made the earth. He made the first man having power to carry light. Then he made the first woman, bright, shining woman.
Doris McLemore is 83 years old and the last fluent speaker of Wichita, a Native American language. The daughter of a white man and a Wichita mother, she was raised by her Wichita-speaking grandparents in rural Oklahoma. She remembers a time when the language thrived in her community.
You know, you could say things in Wichita that were so funny and you wouldn't dare. The way some of them talked, you wouldn't dare say it in English.
But the dominant English-speaking society gradually destroyed the old ways. Generations of indigenous children were shipped off to boarding schools, forced to learn English, and punished for speaking their mother tongue.
The white people did not value it. They wanted it to be gone. Just like everything else, they wanted to annihilate all the Indians.
Now, Doris is the only one left. Sometimes, she says, she dreams in Wichita. The Wichita words for earth and sky, joy and sorrow, will die with her.
How does that make you feel?
You know, I never think about it. It's just the way it is. I don't dwell on it. I just don't think about it.
Wichita is just one of thousands of small languages worldwide on the brink of oblivion, scholars say.
We're seeing an unprecedented pace of language extinction or language death. Approximately half of the world's languages are considered to be endangered, and we may be losing a language as often as one every 2 or 3 weeks.
With the death of each language, an immeasurably valuable piece of humanity's inheritance disappears.
When a community loses its language, they really lose their history, they lose their connection to the past, they lose all of the wisdom and knowledge that has been accumulated through the centuries about how to live in a sustainable manner on this planet.
But extinction need not be the fate of all small languages.
At this school in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, the Cherokee are fighting hard to keep their language alive for a new generation.
It's a total immersion program with all lessons taught in Cherokee beginning in kindergarten. Children read and write in the language using a syllabary developed in the 19th century. And a 21st century tool is helping Cherokee survive, the Ascongo Disk, or in English, the laptop computer, each one equipped with a Cherokee keyboard. Teaching Cherokee at a very early age is essential, says language director Samantha Ben Duke.
The language is being revitalized, that the language is continuing to grow, or is actually beginning to grow and thrive where it was stagnating before. And they will be bilingual and multilingual. They will be world citizens. And yes, they will be passing this on to their own children.
9-year-old Lauren Hummingbird is already passing on her knowledge to her parents.
I'm teaching them to speak Cherokee. They used to take classes, but now they don't.
So you're the teacher at home?
Yeah.
It's a glimmer of hope for speakers of other endangered languages, provided they have the resources and the will to fight for cultural survival. Rob Reynolds, Al Jazeera, Tahlequah, Oklahoma.
So, Andrea, if you will, not to put you on the spot, but, you know, you're what is known as a Latina. You're originally from Colombia, been living in the U.S. most of your life. What do you think about that clip and the role it's played within your community in terms of many Latinos' identification with themselves and even their you know, unconscious assimilation or desire to assimilate with European roots.
And so the first thing that came to mind listening to that clip was they said that the woman, the older woman who was the last speaker of Wichita, is her father was white and her mother was indigenous. And so the majority of Latin Americans or Latinos are mestizo in most countries, not all of them, but that is usually the majority. And so it's interesting for me to see that even she considers herself indigenous, and she has this connection of, well, I might be mixed, but I still have this strong connection to my indigenous roots. And a lot of that is lost, I feel like, in the Latino community, both here and in Latin America. You know, I go back to Colombia every couple years, and the first time I went back since I had come here when I was 10, it was another type of culture shock, because I guess being in the United States, I always felt like an outsider as a person of color, and so it was just a very confusing experience to go back, because it was another take on race and what it means to be, you know, mixed in that country. And so, but to speak mainly to what it is in the United States, although you can make very similar comparisons to what goes on in Latin America now, there's just a lot of confusion and a lot of rejection of your indigenous roots. And so I was looking at this mini documentary about hip-hop in Bolivia, and these were like indigenous Bolivians who are now in the inner cities of Bolivia who rap, and they're talking about people who are indigenous in Bolivia accepting that they're indigenous, and these distinctions where it's not even that some of them are mestizo, it's they're full-blooded indigenous, but if you wear European clothes, as if your mother wears pants, then, you know, that's a way to assimilate into European culture in Latin America, versus does she wear traditional clothes from your tribe. And so that was really interesting, because you see it on so many different levels, both in Latin America and in the U.S. And so in the U.S., the Latino community just doesn't even really think about race. It's just this notion of not just people that are not Latino calling us Spanish or Hispanic or Latin, but it's even within our own community. I've worked with high school students who are Latino who call each other Spanish, and we've had these conversations where I'm like, why are you calling her Spanish or each other Spanish? Like, do you come from Spain? And they're like, no, I'm from Nicaragua, or I'm from El Salvador. And I'm like, okay, so at which point did you start calling yourself Spanish? And it's like, well, that's just what it is. We speak Spanish. And I'm like, exactly, we speak Spanish. But why do we speak Spanish? And so it's this whole historical or part of history that's just been completely lost. It's just like, you know, we attribute everything to Spain. A lot of people consider Spain the motherland, I mean, which is just so ironic. You know, how can you celebrate your Independence Day and so many things about Latin American culture, which our music, our food, is based on Africa and on indigenous people who were in the Americas, but at the same time call Spain your motherland. It's very ironic. I find this clip interesting, and it really made me think about when I went to the Lakota Reservation in South Dakota. Because the first, when I got there and I saw the Lakota people, I was like, if I didn't know that I was on a reservation, like, I would start speaking Spanish to them. I was like, these are my people. Like, this is where I come from. And it was just one of the most amazing experiences of my life. And, you know, the Lakota are in the northwestern part of the United States. And so I don't know, you know, exactly what my ancestors are from, or whatever mix I am, but it was still a profoundly spiritual experience for me, because a lot of the bases of indigenous cultures are similar, and so it was a beautiful thing, and it was just really interesting for me. Even though you know, I've been aware of
indigenous cultures, and I really tried to embrace that part of my culture. It was really eye-opening to really be like, these are indigenous people, and if they were in a store in Maryland, I would have started speaking Spanish to them because I would have thought they were Latino. And so, I just think that that's an interesting thing that I feel like Latinos in the United States, whether you're first generation or you're third generation, is really important to think about. But even in my experience as a social worker working with first generation or just like people who just came like from whatever country, there's no understanding of race. It's like, well, I know I'm from Honduras or I know I'm from Ecuador, but I don't know like what race I am. And so when I have to ask these things because like, you know, we have to categorize it at our job, it's just really interesting to see this complete confusion across the board. Like, and I didn't really expect it from people coming from Latin America, but it is like that. And I've even seen a lot of the people that I work with classify other Latinos themselves being Latino as white, and because they're like, well, they're not black and they're not Asian, and indigenous people are from North America, so they must be white. And I'm like, well, how did you come to that conclusion? Like, we're not white. You know, if anything, there's a mix, and so you could identify that person as a mixed person. That would be the most, accurate thing in my mind. But it's interesting. It's really interesting to see how things play out just because of the language and what we're taught and what we're not taught, more importantly. That, you know, I was looking at this website, the Archive of Indigenous Languages of Latin America, and they're talking about how when the Europeans came, the European invasion of Latin America, there was 1,750 languages. And there were 56 language families and 73 isolates. And so that's crazy. Like, that's huge. And today, there's 40 million, or 10% of Latin America, is indigenous. You know, speaking Quechua, Guarani, Kekechi, Nahua, Hiwara, Wayu, Siapoco, Embeira, Kuna, a ton of languages. I know that in Colombia right now there's about 101 indigenous languages, and the majority of the population is mixed. And so, but really, how many people of that mixed ancestry identify as indigenous, you know, and don't use the term Indio as something derogatory, which means, you know, like, you imbecile, like, you savage, instead of being like, something to embrace, you know, instead of being like, you called me, I am Indian, like, part of my history or part of my roots are indigenous, and that's something that to be proud of, not something that a word that should be used as a derogatory term, which it is. It's very offensive if someone calls you Indian the way that they've framed it, instead of it being something like, you know, powerful and beautiful.
All right. Yeah, and you can go on. I mean, and there's so many languages that you go on and on. I mean, that's just, you know, just some of the indigenous languages of the Western Hemisphere, and certainly, you know, there are probably many more that we can't even name because there's just so many. But there are so many that have died off, that are dying off, and when those die off, a large piece of that culture dies off, and that's why. That piece was so vastly important, is that if you don't, I mean, that's why, you know, you've heard me say this a bunch of times, Andrea, when people say, oh, you don't speak. I said, no, right now I'm trying to learn an indigenous African language. I've been the last year studying Kiswahili. That's important for me. I have close to mastered, you know, one, you know, colonizer language, which is English, and so the next language I want to learn is something that is indigenous with Mother Africa, and so that is Kiswahili, which is what I'm studying right now, and I think it's the same way, vastly important for, you know, Spanish speaking mestizos, Spanish speaking indigenous folks, to reclaim a big part of their culture by studying an indigenous language. You know, whether it's Wichita, that they were just talking about on that piece with Rob Reynolds, and or something else. It's vastly important. It is reclaiming who you are. It is reclaiming who you are. And when you we've been programmed, and as you said, it's been programmed. We people of color in the U.S. have been programmed to shy away from our culture, our cultural roots. We've been programmed to try to assimilate as much as we possibly can with a Eurocentric culture that quite frankly, if we want to break it down, a Eurocentric culture that quite frankly in its roots wreaked havoc and is the reason why we don't know our, you know what I'm saying, we don't know our original languages.
Right.
And so it's a really nefarious, very, very dirty, 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 very, very dirty, trick, you know, to continue to play on a mass of people. And we don't think these things because the educational centers and the corporate media and everything around in America, or most of what we see in America, wants to hide and bury that so much because they want this next class. They want it to be a phenotypically raceless culture. And why is that so important for them? Is that when people start to move away from racial demarcations and so forth, you can't really now point the finger at systematic and institutional racism as the culprit of mass poverty in this area. You can't point the finger at systematic and institutional racism as the culprit of why so many black men in a certain area have been, bloodied, by the police or shot and killed by the police. And that's what they're trying to move this towards and move the dialogue just very, very subtly, very surreptitiously under the radar to a whole bunch of folks who have little to no critical thinking skills, and that is most of Americans. And so, therefore, you're not going to deconstruct what you just said, what you just broke down, looking at Latinos, looking at folks at Pine Ridge. It's so important. And the same thing goes with the shaping of Americanism by way of pop culture. And one of the biggest pieces, components of mainstream pop culture in America is sports. And so we live in an area, I live in an area, I guess I let the cat out of the bag. Yeah, you live in an area as well that is close to a football team known as the Washington Redskins. And usually I say Washington football team, but in this case, I'm going to say it because I'm going to say it just like I would say the Washington niggers or the Maryland niggers or the Virginia niggers. So if that hurts your ears, folks, it should, because I want you to think that terminology. Every time you hear or say the damn word Redskin, that's like that is like referring to them, those people, as niggers. All right? So that is as offensive a term as the term nigger is. And if we don't start to put these conversations in this kind of offensive manner on Front Street, where it puts people in some really compromising and uncomfortable positions, we're going to continue to see these names being venerated. The Washington Redskins, the Cleveland Indians, and you look at the mascot, look at the image of the Cleveland Indians. I mean, we can go on and on and on and on. But when this discussion happens, with what one person in a group of his friends, he becomes outnumbered, and the majority, as in so many cases, is vastly wrong. And they turn to saying, hey, calm down, you're overreacting. It's the Redskins, man. This is our team. Are you kidding me? Change the name of the Redskins? Well, people were actually socially conditioned a different way. these conversations, Andre, would be so much easier to have. And I know you wanted to say something in reference to what we were talking about. What do you want to say?
I just wanted to talk about the terms Hispanic and Latino in the United States and their inception. But before I go to that, since you were talking about the Redskins, I find it interesting that people will often say that, you know, these things, like you were saying, it's not important, it's just part of entertainment, it shouldn't be taken that seriously. But all these things play into a general consensus of what's acceptable. And it creates and normalizes things. And since when did a human being become a mascot? Or why is that acceptable in 2011 that a person of a specific racial group or ethnicity can be used as a mascot for a team? You know, generally mascots are animals, you know? And so these things, like, to me they're really not subtle, but I guess to a lot of people it's just like, oh, whatever. And but even if it is a subtle thing, it brings a certain idea and acceptance of these terms into U.S. culture and what's acceptable. And it's not okay for a person to be considered a mascot and to be equated with an animal, right? And, I mean, words and ideas and images are the basis for ideologies, and ideologies are the basis of our actions. So anyone who says that one word or one image is not a big deal, it is a big deal, because that's what leads to your ideas, and your ideas become your actions. And we see that playing out. There's this disrespect for indigenous culture in the entire Western Hemisphere, where you can see that played out in the politics, where indigenous people aren't even included in constitutions. The fact that they exist and their rights, until recently, for example, you see in Venezuela and in Bolivia, these terms actually being incorporated into their constitutions and being like, yes, we recognize that these people existed before the European conquest and that they deserve their lands back. So it has a lot to do with how we shape our countries politically and the rights that are given to these different groups of people. With the terms Hispanic and Latino, I just wanted to say that Hispanic was, you know, it wasn't invented by the Nixon administration. Yes, before that, the Roman Empire called Hispania was the Iberian Peninsula, and Hispaniola was the Dominican Republic and Haiti before they were separate countries. But in the United States, in the 70s, they didn't know how to classify people from Latin America. And they had tried to use terms like, okay, you know, identify yourself as a person who speaks Spanish. But then there were Equatorial Guineans, which is a country in Africa, who speak Spanish because they were also colonized by the Spanish. Or people from Guam, or people from the Philippines, who might speak Spanish. And so they were like, no, that doesn't really work, because we're trying to focus on Latin America, Central and South America, the Western Hemisphere, and the Caribbean. So how do we identify them? And so they came up with this term Hispanic, which literally means like heritage from Spain, or you are like an extension of Spain, which is also what Hispaniola originally meant. Like it was this term that Spain was like, okay, we're in the New World, and this is our extension of our empire. And so it's just, it basically dilutes our community to being like, well, your entire culture is based on Spain. So what you eat, what you believe, as in the Catholic or the Christian religion, is what you have to abide by. You have to worship this white, blue-eyed, blonde-haired Jesus that looks nothing like most of you, but you're going to worship him, and most people do in Latin America, sadly. But that term in the United States is what they use to describe our community, and it was adopted in the 1980 census. And then Latino came out in the 2000 census, because a lot of people, particularly on the East Coast, were identifying as Latino. It was this kind of emerging term as coming from Latino Americano, but like a shortened term of like, okay, we're first generation. And to be honest with you, like, I've read a lot of different things, and a lot of people have different takes on what these terms mean, but from what I studied in U.S. Latino studies classes and Latin American history classes, this is what the conclusion that I'm coming to. And so the difference between Hispanic and Latino is that Latino incorporates people who are from Latin America but have African, indigenous, and Spanish ancestry. So whether you're one of those or a mix of two or a mix of all three, it incorporates and recognizes those equally. And so I think that, you know, it's important. And I know this is something else that we've discussed before. What does Latino mean, or Latin America, or to be called Latin? And so you can really deconstruct all these terms and come to the conclusion that somehow it's always going to be revolving around Europe and this Eurocentric perspective, like you were saying earlier, because even Latin or Latino or Latin America comes from the notion that Spanish, the root of Spanish is Latin, just like the root of French is Latin. And so after the Monroe Doctrine was passed and the U.S. was really pushing Europe to get out of Latin America so that they could recolonize Latin America, the French and Napoleon really wanted to make this attachment and this connection with Latin America, and they really... they're the ones really who came up with this term to be like, okay, we're not going to just call you Central and South America. You're now Latin America because we have a connection to you, and you should be faithful to us. You should trust us and not the North Americans. So it's important to know all those things. But I will say that in the United States, historically, Latino has become kind of a term of empowerment, and it's been incorporated into the social movements in the community, that and it's seen as a term, a prideful term, just how queer in the LGBT community used to be something derogatory, and then it was embraced by the community and it was given a different meaning. So I think, you know, those are all things to consider, as well as not only considering yourself Latino, but understanding what Latino means. And like I have been saying, like with the woman from what we just heard on Al Jazeera, whether you're full-blooded indigenous or you are mixed, it's important to recognize that you have those roots and really learn that history and understand that just like African-American history in the United States did not start with slavery, our history, Latin American history, did not start with colonization. And there were hundreds of nations within the Americas that had beautiful, you know, spiritual paths and languages and ways of life. And like you said, they were matrilineal for the most part, where the role of the woman was completely different. And when Europeans came to Latin America, they could not understand how a woman was allowed to speak on behalf of her tribe. And so all those things are so important to understand as Latinos, or what, because you could say this about so many different ethnic groups in the United States, but since I'm speaking about it, as Latinos in this country, understanding that our roots are based on that. And so that's a reason that I really respect the Chicano movement and Chicano today, because they have this notion of Aztlan, and Aztlan being the southwestern part of the United States that was stolen from Mexico with the Treaty of Hidalgo Guadalupe. And the fact that, you know, why it's like Colorado is Colorado, or Texas, Arizona, like California, you know, why are all these countries, why do so many people speak Spanish there? Well, it's not just because there's a huge migration from Mexico and other countries south of the border. It's because a lot of people for generations who live there were Mexican American or were Mexican. And so it's not just like you, like, it's just ironic, you know, how you were talking about the changes that are being done in Texas and Arizona to the textbooks of not including anything that's not European history, basically, when these lands were originally not part of the British Empire, or not part of the United States. You know, they were part of Mexico, and they were indigenous land first. But, you know, this notion that... Chicanos have of Aztlan and that being their land
and being rooted and being like, how are you going to push us off of our own land? Like, that's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful consciousness that they have in the West Coast. And I think that a lot of people on the West Coast, on the East Coast, you know, come from so many different countries of Latin America that maybe part of the, that's part of the reason that we don't have maybe the same type of unity and consciousness. But I think that it's something that we need to create across the board. And I have to...
Well, I agree with that. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And, you know, to even, but you're right. As you heard me say, you know, with a lot of folks, you know, the term Hispanic was around before, but it was the Nixon administration that put it on a whole nother level. It was not even being close to being used on that level in America until the Nixon administration. And, you know, so when you say they, it's important for folks to understand that it came out of, largely came out of this administration, the early, mid, late 70s emerged, and Hispanic became an identifying term. It was that administration that put it on a whole new level in terms of its usage within the U.S. And so that's vastly important. But I think that we also have to, when you say, like, even learning things in class, I think that we all have to understand what class is and to deconstruct these classes, because some of these Latin American classes, just like some African American history courses, depending on who's teaching them and what perspective, you may be also getting a limited perspective from that route. And I think that we have to push each other. We have to challenge ourselves within our various communities to deconstruct these terminologies. So at the end of the day, people, you know, can identify with what they want to identify in a more democratic way. And so, yeah, the basis of some English words are Latin-based. So, and there's a lot of indigenous people that don't have any Spanish admixture into them whatsoever that speak Spanish. Are they Latin-based? No. I mean, because I use some English words that are Latin in origin, does that make me Latino? No, but I think it's important for folks to learn these things in a democratic way, to come to understand the derivation of these things, these different terminologies and so forth. And because, you know, when you say even people, you know, sometimes people use things, you know, I came to identify with being referred to as an African based on a number of things. A number of history, you know. So, like, you know, so I thought it was interesting when you mentioned, you know, folks, some folks that refer to themselves as Latino as a source of pride, which is, you know, and good in a way, because they're looking at their culture in a prideful way. But some, as you know, Andrea, some of the people that you were talking about in that don't understand the roots of the term Latino. They don't understand the root. And so it's not just saying, oh, just, you know, I'm going to refer myself as Latino because this is an empowerment, this and the other, because, I mean, shoot, I could use that same case for the word nigger. You know what I'm saying? Where you heard some Africans refer to themselves as nigger and say it's a term of endearment, right? As a term of endearment. Well, the way I've been schooled, that's not a term of endearment. And I know who was at the root of that. You know what I'm saying? That the use of that word, and even looking at the whole derivation from the whole evolution from black people being referred to as colored to Negro to black, right? And so, you know, the reason I prefer to refer to myself as where it was a part of my evolution when I was younger to say, hey, I'm a proud black man, you know, and that was great in that evolution, that epoch in time, because I was grabbing hold of my identity, my phenotypical identity, and slowly, you know, subconsciously and then consciously grabbing hold of my cultural identity and its African roots, which is why I refer to myself as an African now. But black is a color, right? No, yes, it is a color. So so that's why I have some friends who. Some folks, you would look at them visually and say Latino, but these are some of the most conscious friends I have, that are a few of them, you know, that are indigenous Americans, There are a couple of my friends who are Pequot and a couple of my friends who are Musquamicot from Massachusetts, Rhode Island, that, you know, when they talk about their friends who are, you know, either Dominican or what have you, whether they're Afro-Dominican or indigenous, you know, largely indigenous Dominican, they prefer to call themselves the Spanish-speaking indigenous folks or Spanish-speaking Africans, you know, which they're saying, I speak Spanish, but my roots are indigenous. I speak Spanish, but my roots are African, you know, or French-speaking Africans. I've met some folks here who are from, you know, from Ivory Coast, and we've had this discussion, like, why do you refer to yourself, why do you say you're from a, you know, when they describe, well, I'm from a, when they just talk to strangers, I'm from a French-speaking country in Africa. Well, why do you refer to, I'm from a, you know, I've even heard some folks, I'm from a French country in Africa. Like, what that doesn't mean, you know, like, you were socialized to think that somewhere along the lines. And so I think that regardless of what people call themselves, whether it's Latino or Latina or indigenous, you know, you can't really say that, you know what I'm saying, that you're using it as an empowerment if you don't know the history of these different things democratically, broadly, and then say, okay, I'm going to choose to stick with Latina or Latino, or I'm going to choose to stick with, you know, this or that. And that's where the education is so vastly important. And we have to look at our own education and not just looking at the education within classrooms on college campuses, whether it's a Latin American history course or an African American history course or whatever. You know, we have to consider the source of the teacher, the source of the books that are applied, the source of, you know, of all these different things that are occurring, and we have to challenge the perhaps the general consensus in those classes and start the dialogue, but also the education has to also be with us. I mean, that's why I try not to refer to classes as my education. Well, I learned this in this class, or I learned this. No, you know what I'm saying? I've been through all the rigmarole of post-secondary education, you know, college and grad school and so forth. But the basis of the large, the vast majority of the basis of my education and my knowledge has occurred through my own self-adventures, you know, with books and scholarship that I've received from elders who pointed me to those books. And the quid pro quo conversations. I mean, that has been the greatest knowledge and education I've gotten. As Bob Marley says, he said, "I'm not educated because if I was educated, I'd be a damn fool." So it's these things that we have to consider. We have to consider the source, and we have to challenge ourselves to be more aggressive about our educational process and not to necessarily think of education as something that has a roof above it and four walls surrounding it. Education should be something that occurs lifelong and you continue to evolve as a human being, and I think it's vastly important for us who identify being a Sun people of color, living in a Western world, that we need to really take it very seriously, our own cultural edification, if you will. We have to take it very seriously and very aggressively if we're truly to understand ourselves, I've come to identify myself, and each step along the way, I've learned to identify myself in a different way based on knowledge I've acquired, which is where I was younger, and yes, I used the word nigger, you know what I'm saying, to refer to other black boys and so forth, and as I got that knowledge and that information, that terminology was repugnant, and you could not refer to me as that. And then moving to black, And now, you know, in a stage where I am an African. I am an African. That is what I am, because that and within that beautiful term, that word African, is a plethora, is a bounty, a bountiful amalgam of cultures and languages and so forth. You know, 2,000 languages. I mean, it's just huge. It's huge, you know. And understand that culture is so much more real and tangible than that phenotype that has, you know, that phenotype in terms of identifying people based on their color and putting them in that class has only been around for a few hundred years, in that sense. But that's much less real than is my culture as someone whose ancestry is from Timni or from Igbo land and what is now known as part of Nigeria. That's the essence. That to me, that's the essence, and that's what white America and the school systems within United States of America don't want. They don't want this class of people like having this understanding, and they don't want little white kids to learn about and to appreciate so much of what they take for granted each day. Its roots coming from people of color, coming from indigenous people in this, you know, they're not supposed to know that. They're just not supposed to know all of these different things, you know, whether it's monotheism or religion or history or chemistry. They're not supposed to know these things. These things are African, undoubtedly African, undeniably African in origin. And so it's such an important, and you know, we have not even enough time to even to get into, but we do have enough time to crack the surface, which is what we are. And so I want to shift the focus to other parts of the country. I mean, other parts of this large world that we live in that's becoming more and more small for a number of reasons. But you know, for instance, let's take the Maghreb. Let's take North Africa. Why is North Africa referred to as the Middle East? Why is it referred to as the Middle East? Now, I mentioned before why the Middle East is referred to as the Middle East. But why is Egypt referred to as being in the Middle East? There are some adults out there, Andrea, that are grown ass folks that will take it to their deathbed that Egypt is in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Tunisia is in the Middle East. That is the Middle East. That mm-hmm. is the Middle East. And you can even point to onto the map of Al-Kabiland, the original name for Africa, Al-Kabiland, but pointing to the map of Africa and pointing and saying, look, Egypt is in Africa. Egypt is in Africa. That, you know, and the original people that part of Africa, you know, were from the lower Nile regions and migrated up north. That is Africa. Andrea, why is that? I mean, I know, and I also know most Americans could not locate Libya on a map if their life depended on it. I mean, I know that's a whole other thing, Americans and geography. That's a whole other show somewhere down the line. But, Andrea, you know, shifting the focus, you know, because we spent a great deal of time on the Western Hemisphere, but shifting the focus to Africa as well as you know, as Asia. Why the Middle East? Why is Egypt in the Middle East? And maybe it's a loaded question. Maybe it's a trick question. Or, no, it's not. But why do you think it's referred to as the Middle East, and why is that such a dangerous, as we said before, the title of the show, the misnomer? Why is that such a dangerous misnomer?
I mean, I just see it as one of those examples of the education system in the U.S. There's no explanation of different cultures that make up, and different countries that make up Africa, different parts of the world. And so most Americans, they just see brown skin. And so they're like, oh, well, he looks brown, so he must be from the Middle East, because it wouldn't be in Africa. You know, it's just like a lot of people confuse Sikhs who wear the head wraps as Muslim. And, right. And there's just like this whole confusion of like, okay, India is not the same thing as Iraq or Afghanistan. These are different places. But somehow in the United States, they're just all brown. They're all brown people. And I don't know like where they come from. And even though there's like hundreds of languages in India alone, they must all be terrorists. And I mean, it's just, you know, it's really interesting. Or this idea that all Muslims are Arabs and all Arabs are Muslims. Well, the Muslim population in the world is in the billions. Isn't it like 1.5 billion, something like that?
Yeah. Between 1.2 and 1.5 billion. Yeah.
Right. And so most Muslims are not Arab, because there's not that many people who would consider themselves Arab that would make up that number. Most of them are from Asia, and there's a lot of African Muslims. And so it's just interesting that like somehow in the United States, Muslim and Arab have become synonymous. Just the same thing as like Sikh. Most people don't even know that Sikh is a religion, and that it's completely different from Islam. And these are just completely different people, different countries, you know, whatever, different languages. But in the United States, it's just like this blend of
Even within Islam, there are different sects. Just like within Christianity, there are different sects. You know what I'm saying? You have people that are Catholics that fall under the umbrella of Christianity, Protestants, right. I mean, you know, Baptists. And so even within the Muslim community, you know, their holy book is far less tainted than the Bible is, in terms of the Bible has been rewritten and revised and, you know, so many different times, and the Catholic Church uses a completely different Bible than Protestants do. But even within the Quran, if you're a Sunni or a Shia, you know what I'm saying, you know, your interpretation, there are slight interpretations, very subtle, but there are slight differentiations in terms of interpretations. And so that also has to be understood, is that just how, like, all Christians are not alike. They don't all necessarily worship in the same way. You know, a Catholic worships different than a somebody that is Pentecostal. Well, not all Muslims worship the same way. That's vastly important as well. Exactly. You know what I'm saying? To understand those things. And we could go on and on. I mean, looking at different, you know, different religions and so forth. But yeah, it's purposely supposed to be confusing, and for the person that is confused, not to know that they're confused. You're not supposed to know you're confused, because right now Muslims are supposed to be the boogeyman and boogeywoman. They're supposed to be they are supposed to be spared, because Colin Powell said before, quote, we're running out of boogeymen, you know, and that was very, very telling in that statement from him, is because, I mean, he's basically, you know, letting the cat out of the bag that, hey, you know what I'm saying, you know, in order for the U.S. empire to continue to promulgate its death and destruction, and to continue to prop up its military industrial complex, there must be boogeymen, and the boogeymen happen to be right now Muslim, and we see some of the most regressive and backwards thinking and rationale coming out of Washington's Capitol Hill, from Peter King and so many other folks, and I even see folks like, you know, brother Keith Ellison, the Muslim congressman, first Muslim congressman in U.S. history, for him to say this dangerous stuff. Like a couple of weeks ago, Andre. It was like about 3 weeks ago. He was being interviewed on MSNBC by, I believe it was Andrea Kramer. And, no, it wasn't. It was Norah O'Donnell who was interviewing him. And basically, you know, it was after the so-called killing of Bin Laden. Now, you know, we can get into that another time, whether Bin Laden was dead a long, long time before that or not. But he was saying, you know, he was in his car, and his daughter said they were driving and, you know, and talking about it. And she said, you know, that's they killed the man that is responsible for making so many people hate us in America. And he said to his daughter, yes, that's the man. And I thought that's so destructive to tell your young Muslim daughter that's the reason. The reason why so many Americans hate you is not because of Bin Laden. And even deeper than that, if so many Americans hate you for being a Muslim because of, you know, Bin Laden's alleged actions and masterminding of 9/11, if that's the case, that is not a bad testament on you. That's a bad testament on the American people. That is a bad testament on them, and shows how narrow-minded and how racist and institutionally racist this country is. Because a white man can go and blow up a government building in Oklahoma City, and there's no broad-based, you know, fervor or fear, at least for white folks, of all white Protestant, you know, men that are like Timothy McVeigh. And it was extremely destructive, and he played right into that. And I think that they knew that they had a safe one in front of them, a safe one that's going to give a safe answer, and that was a safe answer. And so I thought it was so destructive, because everybody listening right now, listening to that interview and seeing that interview, sees this African Muslim, you know, saying this and saying, yeah, you know, and not saying, you know what, and not saying, no, it's a bad testament on the American people in America that they hate so many Muslims because of Bin Laden's actions. And it shows how ignorant and how uneducated and how far we must go as a society. He could have started with that and checked her and had her have to reel back and really put herself on edge. But no, he stepped into it and said, and just played into that whole, you know, Bin Laden and, you know, and the acts of 9/11. That's why Americans don't hate you because of that. They hate you because they're damn ignorant, and it's a white supremacist society. That's the reason. That's the reason. You know.
I was gonna say the same thing. It's always really interesting for me to see how when there's some kind of tragedy in the United States, and it was because of it was done by a white person. You don't see on newspapers like white man so and so did this crime. It's never made racial, and it's never like it never creates a climate of fear against white people. Just, you know, white people would be offended if we made some kind of correlation between them and these killers, who these psychopaths who chop people up and then put them in, I mean, just crazy things, put them in microwaves. Like, you know, if you were to say, like, oh, you must be like him, I'm scared of you and your family because you're probably going to do the same thing, and they'll be like, well, why would you say that? I'm not like that. Well, you're white and he's white, so you must be like that. You know, that would seem absurd if you put that out there, right? That would be inappropriate, and it would be offensive. But why is there this double standard that when something happens and the person behind it is a person of color, then somehow it can become acceptable to criminalize the entire community, right? So when Virginia Tech happened, there was this climate on all college campuses, even at the University of Maryland, because I remember being there, where there was this huge backlash against Asian Americans on campus because the guy, you know, from Virginia Tech was Korean. And so it's just like, really? That's how stupid people are, that they just jump on because one person does not represent an entire community. There are all types of people within each community, and each community has good and bad people. And so it's just ridiculous how this happens time after time after time.
And it happens in you know, all these different communities of color, but when it's someone from the white community, it's different. Oh, he had a mental disorder. Or he, and it's not, there's always some reason, like Columbine. There was no backlash. There was no, like, oh, now we should be scared and concerned for white boys at middle schools, right? And you didn't see Black and Latino and Asian kids and Muslim children being, like, making fun of white boys because of what happened in Columbine. But if that would have been a person of color, then you would have seen it. And nobody can say that that's not true because we've already seen it, and we keep seeing it over and over again.
Right, exactly. You know, right on point. And the root of it is, I mean, it's ignorance that is it's ignorance that it's like an ignorance pancake that has white supremacy and institutional racism written all over it. Its roots are white supremacy in nature. It is white supremacy. You know what I'm saying? Like, from the most subtle terminologies, Hispanic, you know what I'm saying, it is white supremacist in nature. It is. And even the labeling of, you know what I'm saying, of all Spanish-speaking people as Latino, it is white supremacist in nature. Whether you decide to call yourself that or not, the derivation, it is. Without, you know what I'm saying, they would never, you know what I'm saying, I mean, they would never allow, it's just amazing to me, like, what would not be allowed, you know what I'm saying, if the roles were reversed and what they don't want to address, you know, in terms of terminology. But you're right, that's why it is so dangerous, and this creates a public policy that lends itself into policing where, you know, people of Muslim faith are targeted and people who have more melanin in their skin are targeted, hunted down like dogs, hunted down like, you know, like bloody dogs, you know what I'm saying, on a hunt, you know, as they patrol through the cities. I mean, they're not looking for Billy, you know, so-and-so from, you know, suburbia, you know, wherever, who might be in the city at that time going into that city to try to purchase some cocaine or crack. Which, you know, they're not looking for that. They're not patrolling suburbia America, where just as much, if not more, you know, drug usage is occurring in those parts. They're not patrolling them and hunting them down like dogs. The stats and the data don't lie. You know, you can have your own opinions, but you can't create your own stats and data. And we know that white America uses drugs, you know what I'm saying, at a slightly higher clip than do blacks or so-called Latinos, you know. But their communities are not hunted down in the same manner. So you can keep your little examples and say, oh, well, this white community, such and such, there's a drug rate over there, this, that, and the other. All right, it's about disproportionality. It's
exactly.
Not about this or that. You know what I'm saying? It's about disproportionality because they love to go and bring up that example of, oh, I'm a white man and I was pulled over and such and such and profile this, that, you know, I was pulled over by the cops and so and so. It's about disproportionality, all right? Okay. You know, you're not going to see a bunch of white parents running around saying, I'm sick of those damn black cops coming into my community and roughing up our kids. It ain't happening. But you will have a bunch of African parents, and you know what I'm saying, complaining and protesting to the hilt about how their young African boys are being profiled and being harassed and being brutalized in Pittsburgh and Detroit and Baltimore and D.C. And I can go on and on. It's about disproportionality, and it starts with the cultural education that has been going on in this country, as you said, back to the Monroe Doctrine, but even before that, with Manifest Destiny, you know what I'm saying? And with the whole conquest and usurpation of this land goes all the way back to that. That whole education and looking at even Bacon's Rebellion. You know what I'm saying? You know, because, you know, Governor, you know, Berkeley, you know, was not hard enough on the so-called Indians. you know, and so this guy rounded up his band of Cretans, you know, it's been entrenched. You cannot have the beginnings. You can't have, you know, anytime you have the beginnings in terms of where you look at European conquest of this part of the world, as well as other parts of the world as well, but looking at this part of the world, you cannot have that kind of history, or that kind of those kind of beginnings, Andrea, without it being sustained by mythology, by white supremacy, you know. And when I say that lends itself into the educational systems, and as we know, you know, how even you know, indigenous folks were rounded up, and when they went into these schools, you know, they changed their names. Your name is now your name used to be, you know, Bluebird or Thunderfoot, and now your name is Billy or Christopher. I mean, it is all about a white supremacist blanket being placed over the nation, and being placed over much of the world, and when that happens, and there's no breaking up about it, you know, in a so-called free society, free of indentured servitude and free of so-called race or slavery, except we see slavery in another form in U.S. prison systems. But you can't talk about an advanced society when the educational system in 2011 does not reflect, Andrea, the whole history of nomenclature in terms of entire peoples, the whole education of the shifting of culture and the identification of people, the whole education of why their land, you know, why they've been historically oppressed and why they are on these things called reservations and why their numbers, until that education occurs, we don't have a society that is free of white supremacy. And we can't have a society that is free of white supremacy until that education happens on a mass level, because without that education, we're going to have the continued regurgitation of these policies. Because it's not just about sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. It is about these damn freaking names and these damn terminologies and these damn classifications and identification with people, say, Muslim as being terrorists, people that are so-called black as being criminals, and it lends itself to public freaking policy, and public freaking policy kills Oscar Grant, and public policy kills Sean Bell, and public policy kills Timothy Stansbury, and public policy kills and kills and kills and kills and it kills and it kills until what happens? Not till it stops. People have to stop it. It kills until it's second nature. It is second nature to kill a black man in this country. It is second nature. And yes, all these things are connected. Folks, it is not simply this or that that Andrea and I have been talking about. It is not this and that that Sarah was talking about earlier. It is about a mixture of them all together, and it's about wires crossing called intersectionalities, and how these happen to induce havoc and chaos by way of institutions that are built around racism, that institutions that are built around sexism, that are institutions that are built around xenophobia. That is how they happen, people. It is not black and white. I know you want to have the simple conversation, some of you, that is this and that. No, and that's why I was taking it a step further with the term Hispanic and Latino and black and African. It's not even just about saying I'm prideful, this, that, and the other, because I learned this and this. And that. We have to take it a step further and look at the derivation and then go from there and then go and look at these policies, because that's exactly how we're coming to identify Muslims as Arabs and Arabs as Muslims, and forgetting that they are as complex a people as those folks who refer to themselves as Christian, as complex, you know, and we're not, you know, we're not having these conversations in the right places. We're not having them enough. And until Andrea, we you know, and Sarah, who I see is on the line, I'm going to get you on the line in a second, Sarah, until we start taking these conversations as seriously as life or death, life and death, then what's going to continue to happen on our watch is that life and death are going to occur, and premature death is going to occur. And Sean Bell and Oscar Grant, they're not going to be the last ones, and they haven't been the last ones. They haven't been the last ones by a long shot. And so we have the Ayanna Stanley Jones, 7-year-old African girls in Detroit, being murdered by the police with no jail time, no anything, public outcry on a mass scale. These things are linked to institutional racism and white supremacy. And Sarah, I'll let you chime in. Sarah, I've got you on the line.
Hello again.
Hello?
Brother. Hello, can I be heard?
How you doing? Yes, you
yes,
can.
Yes, hello, Brother
heard.
Solomon and Sister Andrea again. Thanks again for having this dialogue. And this is something what you are teaching. It's something that we need to put in all of the Boys and Girls Clubs. It needs to be taught at home so that people would know themselves and know their history. What Andrea was speaking of with the Americas and what was done with the indigenous people, and what, especially in this country, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo that carved up the
yes.
state of Republic of Mexico and put Colorado, California, Arizona, and all of those states into the Americas. I have a well-known an attorney that does. Her name is Dr. Jacqueline Badalora. And she did a seminar, and she from going over this, and she said when this after the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, when all those people, Spanish speaking, indigenous people, were one day they were in Mexico, the next day they were in the Americas. Said 90% of those people had land, and they owned their own homes as a result of this treaty. She said within a matter of 10 years, systematically. It was down to less than 30% of those people in those areas that were still landowners owning their own homes. People like to speak a lot about the Texas Rangers and give them all of these props. The Texas Rangers, that's where they came in. But all the bloodshed and the massive slaughters that they did to these indigenous people to put them off their land so that these homesteaders from back east could come out west and claim land, which were owned for centuries in these people's hands. But that is the history of this country, and people ask, well, they need to go back home. No, that's why you have all of these Spanish-sounding names in California, Texas, and all of these places, because this is all a part of the state of Mexico.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. You're exactly right. And even taking it to a step further, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the Texas Rangers, but, you know, when you look at even, you know, for instance, the naming of cities. I mean, San Francisco. I mean, the San Franciscan monks were a bunch of devils masquerading around as Christians. I mean, these folks were vile. You know what I'm saying? They you know, just like the San Diego monks, they were vile. They you know, hired, you know, mercenary, you know, 49ers and other, you know, bands of hooligans to you know, push indigenous folks off of the land. I mean, this is what they were. And did we forget that the Catholic Church was at one time the largest, you know, slave trading institution and slave promulgating institution that the world had known? I mean, come on, folks.
They got the Pope give the go ahead for them to go ahead and start the slave trading business. It came from the Pope out of the Vatican in Rome. So all of these Catholic churches, and which makes me, I cannot understand why these indigenous people, which are the biggest upholder of the faith in Latin and Central America, is that they are still there being oppressed by the same people that caused them to be in this state of dysfunction that they find themselves in. Because it's the same church. These churches, again, we come back again to these churches, and I keep telling people, I said, no offense to anyone who are practicing Christianism, but to me, I don't espouse any religious doctrine or faith. because especially with the church, I'm extremely hard with them because I tell people, I said, you always find crosses where there is the dead. You go to the graveyard, you find cross. You go to church and you find it's dead because they don't give you anything of nutrition in these churches. They make you dependent because all they do is they dumb you down. They make you dependent. They make you look up to pastors as if they are your saviors and you have to keep coming back and back to them. You idol worship them. That's what they do.
Right. Yeah, you're exactly right. Once again, Sarah, you're right on. I mean, and I'm glad you and Andrea like set the table with that. I mean, that's it's so important. And I mean, like, and even, you know, when we look at even like the term out, like, you know, Oriental, some people still refer to Asians as Oriental, and it's just like, come on, man, it's just come on. I mean, it's on purpose. I mean, the U.S. is being, the U.S. is, you know, is likes to say, U.S.A. number one, everything's like all competitive, but number one in what? Number one in most obese nations in the world, number one in the most ignorant and, you know, dumbed down nation in the world, you know, where most Americans, you know, when you ask them to name, you know, five countries in the continent of Africa, they can't even do that. I mean, it's pathetic, but that's where you have this stuff, you know, and you have that nitwit that called in some weeks ago, Sarah, when you first called in, you know, referring to them as peasants, referring to you know, so-called Latinos as peasants, and how when these Latinos come into the community, they bring down the property value. Motherfucker, listen, man, you want to be real about it, man. They brought down the property level. How about when your ancestors, your ancestors coming over from England and Europe, you know, how they came over there and they brought, as you mentioned, Sarah, so rightly, disease and destruction and rape and murder and all that stuff. That's not bringing down the property level. They brought down the population level. They brought down the population level. So if folks want to migrate, you know, saying back, you know, to the U.S., their rightful places of land, like, so be it. I mean, but the U.S. Congress is not willing to have that conversation in an open hearing and to talk about the roots, all right, and talk about the genocide of indigenous folks in this country, to see how their numbers are so now whittled down, and for some reason we're not calling it a Holocaust, the same way we're not calling what happened to the Africans as a Holocaust, over 100 million. Like, come on.
You are,
they're bringing down the property value? Oh, go on, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry, Andre, I don't mean to cut you off. You know, which you are so right about that, because these people, they have, as you said, with these murdering people, if they could not live amongst themselves in Europe, what makes you think they're going to come out here and they're going to live amongst other people, other civilized people? These people came here and the First Nation people showed them how to live, how to plant crops, how to domesticate animals, and what did they get in return? They slaughtered them, and then they turned a holiday into it, and then they made Westerns to glorify what they did to these people. And be everybody sitting up there on Saturdays going to say, oh, I'm going to go and see a Western, the glorification of your slaughter and genocide that you did to the indigenous people.
Right on.
And
right
people
on.
Don't
Andrea,
these things when they look at these Western movies.
Right on. Right on. Right on. Andrea, she's right on with the Westerns. She's right on with the Westerns. They are.
Listen, I get offline. Andrea, I don't know if y'all had a chance to see Skip Gacy did a special for PBS. It's called Blacks in Latin America. It's a four-part series.
No, I didn't.
I did.
Okay, you can pull it up on PBS. You can watch it online on PBS. And he covered the Latin America. He went from Haiti to the Dominican Republic, Cuba, Brazil. He covered, he did not go into Colombia because there's a very large, you know, there's a very large black population in Colombia as well as in the other areas there in Central America and Panama. You didn't touch on those areas. But it's very informative, and it showed you how these Europeans, I did not know that there were 16 different classifications of blackness.
Mm-hmm.
They have a map that they showed you in Mexico where they showed you the different people, the different combination of blacks with different groups and what would classify them as what forms of blackness. So it would blow your mind when you watch that series. But when you get a chance, pull it up online and watch it. It's called Black in America.
Definitely. Thank you.
Oh, y'all are so welcome. Y'all are talking and I listen.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling in again.
All Thank you. Welcome.
Take care, sir.
Okay.
So Andrea, she was right on with the West. I mean, she was right on with everything she was talking about. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if you have any thoughts on what Sister Sarah was talking about, but she was right on point. She was right on point as usual, and contributed to the conversation and the show mightily once again.
Definitely, yeah. No, I mean, you know, that's what it is, and it's great to have people call in and share their perspectives and add to, you know, contribute to the conversation, because that's really what conversation is about, like giving a platform to the community to speak about these issues that aren't usually talked about in other media outlets. So it's definitely great to have people like Sarah on the show.
Right, exactly. And so I mean, and what we're trying as you know, as we have like 10 minutes left and we start to close, folks. You know, we can't get into the whole breadth of things, and you know. We had certain things that we wanted to talk about, and we knew the conversation was gonna take a life of its own. But that's what it's about. That's what, you know, healthy dialogue is about. It sometimes it takes a life of its own, and you know, we have to bring up our different, you know, perspectives on things, and even, you know, within this dialogue, you could even see some of the nuances that Andrea and I share in terms of nomenclature and you know, identification with certain terminologies. I'm at a point of this in my life where, you know, I really don't want to be identified with anything that had a European basis in it. And so I just know that, you know, I don't, you know what I'm saying? It's important for me now to you know, as an African, you know, with brown skin, for me to continue to reclaim my culture, and damn it, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, you know, no one would say that to an Italian American or a Polish American or an Irish American. No, no one would say anything to them about it. Just, you know, because they have reclaimed and grasped, and their culture is all around them every time they step outside the door and inside the house. I mean, they know so much about European history, you know, even it's and so much about it, even to the extent where the most dastardly and reprehensible things that have to do with European history are revered and venerated, you know, and reveled, you know, within the U.S. culture, and it's a part of the culture. So I'll be damned if anyone's going to tell me that there's anything wrong with me identifying with myself as being an African, you know, first and foremost. I'll be damned if anyone's going to, you know. And so even if I'm from, you know, Trinidad or Jamaica before my ancestors got there, they were African. Okay, they were African. And these people were indigenous before they were Latino or Hispanic. Okay, and the languages that, you know, that they use. And even those folks who are an admixture of you know, European and indigenous. I mean, when it comes down to it, I fully support, you know, so-called mestizos, you know, seeking out their indigenous roots, because most of them, you know, would be called spick around, you know, around, you know, certain places within America readily. The word term spick would roll off people's mouths like it's nothing, you know. And, you know, as Malcolm once said, he's like, man, you know, I was called nigger so much that I thought that that's what I was. I thought that that's what I was. I was called nigger so much that I thought that that's what I was, you know. And, you know, and you could say you speak Spanish. You could say you speak English. You could say you speak French. That don't make you French, man. That don't make you French. That's not, you know, that's not, you know, that may be a part of your life and your culture, but looking at the roots and how, and I thought it was so beautiful when you brought it up, Andrea, is that when you talked about having that conversation with other folks from your community, why asking them that so important question, Andrea, saying, why do we speak Spanish? Why do we speak Spanish? Because, Andrea, that is the question. That is the $60,000 question, Andrea. When you ask them that question, they can't run. They cannot run. They may not know, and they may not be ready to even be able to articulate that. But that's when you come in, and that's where other folks come in to drop that knowledge and to drop that and say, "This is why you speak Spanish." And like, mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, you break it down. Like, oh, I never even thought about that. But that's right. Shoot, it was imposed on me. And then Andrea, oh, here's the scary one. You know where I'm going with this one, Andrea. You know that's one thing, Andrea. But how? Andrea, you tell me how difficult it is for you to go into the Latino community and have the conversation of why do you practice Roman Catholicism? is that a difficult conversation to have?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that's more. That might be more difficult than talking about the language thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, that takes it, I think, for a lot of people to a whole other level. Like, it's what they believe in. It's the way they were raised. It's what they know. It's like Sarah was saying, like, how, you know, majority of the people who continue with the practicing Catholicism are indigenous or mixed with indigenous. And it's really an interesting and very sad thing to see.
Right. I know this, but like, do you practice Catholicism, and if so, why? And if not, why not?
No. I was raised Catholic. When I was around 10, I didn't understand as profoundly as I do now my issues with the Catholic Church, but I felt that something wasn't right. I could see very basic things like why priests and nuns had different roles, and then on a racial level, why you look at the Vatican and it's all white men, and why do they have churches made out of gold while people who practice Catholicism in Latin America are living in shacks. And so those things were things that were enough at that age to see, like, I couldn't really put all the pieces together, and I didn't understand the complexities and all the issues and the isms. But I saw those very basic things, and that was enough for me to not want to practice that religion. And I didn't, you know, I could see through the hypocrisy of people who practice Catholicism and going to church and, you know, just a lot of things. And as I got older and I started studying indigenous spirituality and my experience, like I told you, in the reservation in Lakota, really opened my eyes to justifying my feelings when I was a young girl. And really gave me a solid historical basis as to why my gut feeling was right. And so I think that, you know, that's why it's so important to have that knowledge and that history of yourself and your people, because it gives you a more accurate perspective on what options you have and why you should adhere to something or why you should not adhere to something else. I'm not Catholic.
Right. That's folks, and that's a whole nother show. We've done shows on in the past, and maybe we'll do them in the future again. It's breaking down religion, and as Sarah said, you know, she doesn't, you know, adhere to any religious sect or whatever, nor do I. Spiritual, and that's and even within that, my spirituality is between me and myself and those close to me, but I don't adhere to any religious, identification. You know, when you learn the history of Christianity and how it was reshaped by Europeans and how it was used to pacify and to mentally control everyone from Africans to indigenous Americans, you know, indigenous people in the Western Hemisphere, it's hard to go back to it, and I can just say that. Well, you know, it's hard to go back to it, you know, and so even if I wanted to, I couldn't. I just know too much, and there's no way. You know, I believe in a higher being. That being does not have a gender. And if it did have a gender, it would be a woman. Knowing that the matriarchal societies started in Africa, and the first cultural societies that came out that were in this world were undoubtedly matriarchal. So if it had to be a gender, it would be, but it's not. You know what I'm saying? And so, anyways, you know, Andre, I want to thank you again, and we have another great show coming up next week. So I want folks to tune in. And for Andrea, I'm Solomon. This is another edition of Your World News. Thanks for tuning in, and you know, look forward to seeing you on the same black channel, the same black time.
Definitely, thank you.
No problem. Peace and unrest.